I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 16th of February. Very interesting piece in the current issue of Vanity Fair. The title of the piece is Blood Oil: Could a Bunch of Nigerian Militants in Speedboats Bring About a U.S. Recession? Our guest, who's a distinguished author, spent some time with some of those Nigerian militants and writes a piece about blood oil. Sebastian Younger is the author of the piece and traveled there. At great risk to his life, I think. He didn't know what he was going to encounter here. He is the author of The Perfect Storm, A True Story of Men Against the Sea, which is about the loss of the Gloucester fishing boat off the coast of Nova Scotia. It was made into a movie, you may recall, a big movie. He established the Perfect Storm Foundation to provide cultural and educational grants to children whose parents make their living in the commercial fishing industry. And he's written very widely about, all kinds of issues. He has reported on war, terrorism, and human rights from Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Kosovo, reported from Afghanistan for ABC News, was a freelance radio correspondent during the war in Bosnia, and his work has appeared in Harper's, the New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, Adventure, Outside, Men's Journal, and his article, The Forensics of War, about war crimes at Kosovo, won a National Magazine Award for reporting. He's joining us this hour of the program and will be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 227-2050. Hi, Sebastian.
Hi there.
Do you ever take one of these assignments and think, because I thought when I read the article, whew, glad that you're back alive.
Sometimes I've been very frightened on these things, and it's either way, it's always nice to get home. I should just point out for your listeners, the issue actually just came off the stands, but if they want to read my article, it's on VanityFair.com.
VanityFair.com.
Yeah, just to update you.
All right, we will take it from there. You start the article with this pretty interesting meeting, 2005, June 23rd, Four Seasons Hotel in Washington, D.C. What happened?
Well, a conference was convened of very high-level people from the Defense Department, the energy sector, former heads of the CIA, very, very high-level people, to study what might happen if there were different kinds of crises in the American oil supply, in the oil flowing into the United States. One of the scenarios that they looked at was a crisis in Nigeria. Nigeria is particularly important because it's one of the, I think it's the fifth largest oil supplier to the United States. It's a major supplier, but it's also, it's very pure. The oil comes out of the ground very, very pure. It needs almost no refining. It said in Nigeria you can pump it straight into your car and you could drive. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's very pure oil, and so it's very valuable in the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was a political crisis in Nigeria that shut down Nigerian oil supply, it was thought that oil prices for America could go up to $80 a barrel.
Mm.
$80 a barrel in the world market, which would trigger real economic troubles for us, but troubles that we would recover from. And one of the things about the oil market is that as oil goes up, use goes down, and then the price stabilizes and comes down again. It's sort of a self-regulating mechanism. What this panel found, though, was that Nigerian oil effectively is the cushion that we have between us and crises in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And without that cushion, we're then incredibly vulnerable to any political catastrophe in the Middle East, a terrorist attack, anything like that. So a crisis in the Nigerian supply followed by anything in the Middle East would send oil prices to over $120 a barrel, and that could cause a major recession in the United States.
And lo and behold, less than 7 months after that meeting you described, we have this huge event in Nigeria where almost what they were looking at the year before took place.
Yes, I mean effectively it's almost as if they'd been given walk-on parts in the scenario. Militants in the Niger Delta, where oil is pumped, most of the oil that comes out of Nigeria is pumped out of the Niger Delta. militants from that area started taking Western hostages, taking over oil rigs, attacking oil supply boats, basically paralyzing the oil industry in Nigeria. It was exactly the kind of crisis that this oil shockwave panel envisioned in their in their projections.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, because you spent some time with these people, and I want you to tell the story, too, of how you met with them and how you got there and some of your fear in meeting with this group, the militants calling themselves the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta.
Yes, I mean, there's actually many militant groups in the Niger Delta, ranging from completely criminal enterprises that really are just outfits for stealing oil. It's called bunkering oil. They literally tap the oil out of the pipelines and sell it on the international market with the collusion, very often the collusion of the Nigerian military and Nigerian authorities. So militant groups range from that to the really quite principled and idealistic MEND, Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. And it runs the whole gamut. There's everyone in between. I encountered MEND. And I say that a little hesitantly because the Niger Delta is a very confusing place, and you're never quite sure who you're talking to. But it seems as though I encountered a part of the MEND movement. We went into the creeks. We thought, with the assurance from someone who was connected to the militants, with the assurance that we would be okay. It's not the kind of place you just take a boat into.
No, yeah.
To talk to some militants, it doesn't quite work that way. Particularly
right.
Because they were kidnapping Westerners and holding them hostage for weeks at a time. So we got the assurances of a local Ijaw, the tribe, the tribal group in the Niger Delta is primarily Ijaw. And we got the assurances of a local Ijaw political leader, that we would be okay, that he would call for us ahead to MEND to say to receive us well. And we went into the creeks to this little village where we were told to go and wait for MEND. And MEND, sure enough, MEND arrived. They converged on us very, very heavily armed. They thought we were spies. Mm. And what followed was a very, very tense semi-hostage situation that eventually was resolved, and we ended up going into the creeks a couple of weeks later, with actually a real connection. I mean, we actually were invited back by MEND and did get to meet them under better conditions.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to understand all this incredibly rich oil. Lots of oil, and you contrast that with, as you write in the article, the appalling conditions in which most of the Delta inhabitants live. No schools, no medical clinics, no social services, no clean drinking water. How can that be?
Well, that's one of the things about this story. I mean, Africa is a very poor continent. I worked all over West Africa, and it's not surprising to go into a village that has no sanitation, no school, no clean drinking supply, etc. That's not a shocking thing in West Africa. What's very disturbing about the Niger Delta is that those conditions exist in a village, in most villages, and right next to that village is an oil well, a Shell oil well, an Agip oil well. It's the contrast of this incredible poverty that, of course, gives rise to terrible diseases and a very high infant mortality and that kind of thing, right next to the infrastructure that pumps billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil a year. It's that juxtaposition that I think is shocking to journalists and enraging to the local people.
Mm-hmm. And it results in organizations like MEND being formed.
Exactly. I mean, MEND's position is if we, the people of the Niger Delta, are not going to benefit from the oil, nobody is. We will kidnap people. We will destroy oil infrastructure until there's no oil industry at all, and no one will benefit.
Mm-hmm.
The Nigerian government is pulling in roughly $1 billion, $1 billion a week.
Wow.
Of oil revenue, yes. Most of it is fees paid by foreign oil companies for the right to drill oil in the Niger Delta. Almost $1 billion a week. And the oil companies, as their contracts are written with the Nigerian government, are discharging their obligations fairly. I mean, they're paying 60%, 70%, 80% of their take their profit goes right back to the Nigerian government. The problem is that the Nigerian government is just so indescribably corrupt that very little of that immense fortune trickles down to the back down to the Niger Delta. That's the problem.
What in the world do you do with $1 billion a week? Where's the money going?
Well, there's a lot of governors with $100 million palaces and helicopters and prostitutes and whatever, you know. Wow. People find a way to spend it. I mean, there are a lot of political leaders who have townhouses in London and in Washington, D.C. and Paris. And, I mean, the money gets spent.
Mm-hmm. And what about this stated aim of our aim is to totally destroy the capacity of the Nigerian government to export oil? Tell me about the strength of these militant groups. Could they indeed do that?
Well, thus far, MEND, which popped into existence a little bit more than a year ago, but again, on the heels of other militant groups that were less organized and I think a little bit more, frankly, criminal. Since then, they have cut Nigerian oil production by a quarter, by roughly 25%.
Hmm.
Every time there's an attack, the barrel price of oil in the world market goes up a couple of dollars, which is not a huge amount, but it does ripple through the system, and it is an indication that if there were a sustained crisis in Nigeria, it might not be a couple of dollars, it might be $20, and then you would start to we Americans would start to feel that at the gasoline pump. The problem is, I mean, it's not as if this is a social movement that could topple the government. I mean, it's localized, it's in the Niger Delta. The problem is that the oil infrastructure is so hard to protect. There's some 4,000 miles of oil pipeline belonging to Shell alone, just one oil company.
Hmm.
You can't protect 4,000 miles of pipeline. You could always blow up a section of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's hundreds and hundreds of oil wells. There's offshore, even the offshore rigs. MEND at one point took over an offshore rig that was 50 miles offshore and took everyone on the rig hostage. They just put them in boats and drove them back to the swamps. There's really no way to protect the sprawling oil infrastructure of the Delta. So if they wanted to, they could severely damage Nigerian oil output. It's a delicate game of brinksmanship that they're playing with the government. I mean, if they launched a catastrophic attack on the oil infrastructure, the Nigerian military might really wage a scorched earth campaign that would severely damage MEND. On the other hand, I think the military doesn't quite do that for fear of prompting a catastrophic attack. So there is this sort of, like, game of chicken that they're engaged in, and it's hard to tell exactly which way that will go.
Mm-hmm. And what about, Sebastian, the environmental damage in this area? You talk about no clean drinking water, but there have been oil spills in the area, right?
Yes, there have been catastrophic oil spills in the last 20 years. There's also a sort of more low-level, just slow leaking of oil from wellheads. And frankly, oil gets spilled when militants tap the pipelines and literally suck crude out of the pipelines into barges, and then they sell that oil offshore back into the international market for huge amounts of money. But, you know, of course, that's sometimes a sloppy operation. So some of the oil spills are from this bunkering, this stealing of oil. Whatever the sources of it, it has polluted a lot of the drinking water, and it has killed much of the fish stock. These people live off fishing.
Mm-hmm.
They fish from dugout canoes. These villages are very, very primitive affairs, thatch huts, no electricity, nothing. And they've always lived off fishing, and now the fish stocks are pretty devastated. And that is from the oil damage to the environment from oil spills.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Sebastian, and we'll take them in a moment. His piece is in Vanity Fair, Blood Oil. Could a bunch of Nigerian militants in speedboats bring about a U.S. recession? And he went to the Niger Delta to answer that question in this very lengthy piece, which is in Vanity Fair. You can get it now. I guess it's off the newsstands, but vanityfair.com if you want to read about his story and his dangerous trip to the Niger Delta. Our number, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls. Well, not more. We go to the first phone calls for Sebastian, starting with Ron from Madison. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Please recap briefly the 20th century history of Nigeria, you know, for independence, I think, from the British Empire. But I'm mainly interested in how the various ethnic and national groups, how much relative power they have within the current structure. It's my contention that Nigeria is also an empire, meaning that one ethnic or national group has most of the power and that the rest of the people don't. Currently, the big problem is the Niger Delta, and that's that ethnic group is being, their stuff is being stolen by the central government and Shell. Back in about 1970, there was a huge civil war when the eastern part, called Biafra, I believe, tried to secede. I don't know if you can cover that, but that was a distinctly different ethnic group than the ones who control the military. And could you give any percentage numbers of the different ethnic groups in the population as a whole versus the numbers of ethnic people in the military? Is the military overwhelmingly one ethnic group that controls the country? Thanks.
Yeah. All right, there you go.
Sebastian. All right, well, I can't quite start spitting out numbers here, but what I can say, yes, there was a civil war in Biafra. I believe it was in the 60s. It was an enormous number of people died. Right now, the situation is one where the government and the military primarily come from the north of Nigeria. The Hausa tribe dominates the government and, I believe, the military. And so when you're in the Niger Delta, primarily you don't see soldiers from the Niger Delta. You see northern Nigerians in the military controlling things in the Niger Delta. That's in a situation in which tribal relations are already extremely tense, even between tribes within the Niger Delta. So this sort of upper layer of Hausa government and military is very provocative. And you might remember, I think it was about a year ago, there were terrible massacres that broke out between Muslims and Christians. The south is mainly Christian, the north is mainly Muslim. And there were terrible massacres and retaliatory massacres that happened in Nigeria about a year ago. And it was a Christian conflict, but within the Christian, it was a religious conflict, but within the religious division, there are neat tribal divisions that sort of amplify the violence. So just to answer you generally, I don't have the numbers of the proportions of the various tribes in Nigeria, but when you're in the Niger Delta, you're very aware of this sort of the tribal element to the tensions, mm-hmm. to the tensions there.
Thanks, Ron, for the call. Let's go to Bill next from La Crosse. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon, or good morning. Mr. Younger, you're an outstanding writer. I've read many of your things.
Thank you.
This is a phenomena which is a portion of an even greater issue for us, which is this issue of peak oil. Peak oil itself, any dislocation, even in Nigeria or Tajikistan or other production area, is going to really seriously impact our society as a whole.
That's right. You know, in peak oil, it's one of those very controversial topics that can get you into an argument incredibly quickly. and it's something that I think is a very valid concern. I don't know if the last word is in on it or not, but certainly what I understood about, I'm an outsider coming to the oil industry. There's nothing, I was sort of learning as I went, as I did this article, but my understanding is that oil will be economically not viable long before it's actually run out. And by that, I mean the very easily tapped oil sources in the world are starting to diminish their supply, which means we have to go to other sources of oil, like the oil-rich sands in Canada, sand deposits in Canada, where you can get oil. It's just more costly to extract oil from those areas. And so and I'm going from memory here, but I believe when they first started to tap oil, to drill oil over 100 years ago, it took roughly one barrel of the oil energy to extract 50 barrels of oil from the ground. So a barrel of equivalent energy to get back 50 from the ground. And now it's something like 1 to 5. Eventually, if you're at 1 to 1, oil is no longer viable as an energy source. So that's one of the equations that the concept of peak oil is wrestling with.
Mm-hmm. References, if I may, The Long Emergency by Kunstler and Resource Wars by Michael Clare, which really lay out are in parallel with what you're saying about what's happening in Nigeria. But this is actually happening all over the planet in lesser degrees.
That's right. And people who argue that peak oil is not valid, they say, well, there's new deposits being discovered here and there. The point is that those new deposits often are economically less accessible. It costs more, for example, to drill oil from a deep ocean oil rig than it does from a land-based rig. And people are having to go offshore, so it costs twice as much to get the oil, and eventually oil just becomes less and less economically viable. That's ultimately the point of peak oil, is that we won't be able to afford to drill enough oil anymore.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. You mentioned President Bush's State Department declaring in 2002 that, along with other African oil imports, it was considered a strategic national interest. The president could send in the U.S. military to protect our access to it. Where does that stand now?
I don't think it's changed since then. Strategic national interest means that we can. It's something that's in the national interest, and we can use our military to protect our access to it. I should add, though, that would be at the invitation of the Nigerian government.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't an invasion. This wouldn't be an invasion of Nigeria. Nigeria would turn to the U.S. presumably and say, "We're having trouble containing the militants in the Niger Delta. They're disrupting oil supply. Can you come in and help us deal with them militarily?"
Mm.
And President Bush has the legal authorization to do that. But it's interesting to note that a few months ago, the president of Nigeria asked for a contingent of Marines to be based in the Niger Delta to help safeguard the oil supply, and President Bush said no, that we did not want a U.S. military presence there. If we weren't tangled up in Iraq, I don't know, maybe perhaps that would seem like a viable scenario, but right now that was turned down.
Yeah. So is there a Nigerian military in charge of protecting the oil, or?
Well, there is. There is a Nigerian military. They're a very forceful bunch. I mean, as a journalist working down there, you'd almost rather be caught by militants than arrested by the Nigerian military.
My.
They're a very, very frightening group. And as I said, they're mainly from the north. They're not local people. And they're very poorly paid. And what that means is that it's very easy for the militants to buy them off. And when the militants bunker oil, when they steal oil, very often they pay off the local military commander, not just to look the other way, but to actually help them guard the barges full of stolen oil from other militant groups that might want to hijack them. So they're actually paying for the protective services at times of the Nigerian military. Other times there are terrific, huge firefights in the Delta between military patrols and militants. One of the things about these guys, these militants, is that they believe in many of them believe in a basically a warrior cult that's dedicated to the god Egbesu. Egbesu is the Ijaw god of war. And they believe that by performing certain ritual functions, purifying themselves, painting their bodies with white paint, and often these guys have amulets and sacred charms tied to their bodies, that if they do this, they will be bulletproof. And so when they actually engage the Nigerian military, when there are these firefights, they fight very, very bravely. They're completely uncowed by firepower, and in the psychology of battle, that actually is very effective. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have an enemy who is completely unconcerned with the hail of bullets you're sending his way, that's very intimidating. And in effect, this idea of being bulletproof, whatever you choose to believe, whether you or not you choose to believe that literally, the effect in battle is not inconsequential. These guys are very, very intimidating in battle, and often the Nigerian military, or I've heard that the Nigerian military has at times simply dropped their weapons and run away.
Oh, my gosh. Well, one of them was challenging you. One of them was saying the Niger Delta people are the new world power. I don't have a bulletproof vest, but I can drink acid. Can you drink acid?
That's right. One of the aspects of this Egbesu cult is that they can, not only are they bulletproof, but they can do things like drink battery acid without harm. I never saw. I didn't ask anyone to prove it to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's like any magical belief. It partly derives its power from belief, and if you believe that you are bulletproof, you act that way, and others perceive you that mm-hmm. way, and it's sort of self-fulfilling. And mm-hmm. there's a bit of that. I mean, Nigerian society is very aware of witchcraft and magic, and it's not that hard to convince your enemy that maybe bullets might glance off you. It's mm-hmm. not an inconceivable thing.
Yes. Let's go to Pat from Brookfield. Where are you from, Pat?
Brookfield.
Brookfield.
Yes.
Hi, Pat.
Good morning. Thank you. I can't wait to read the article in Vanity Fair. I just have a question. I'm confused when you say that the oil companies are paying their fair share of their profits to the government, but the government's so corrupt that these profits don't get to the people. Is this a similar situation that we had, like, say, in Iran in the 50s when they had a democratically elected, you know, government, Mossadegh, and when Mossadegh went to the oil companies and said, you know, we want more of the money for our people, you know, our government with the, you know, with the oil companies, whatever, you know, kind of joined together and overthrew this democratically elected government and put the Shah back in power. And how is this in Nigeria? I mean, although the oil companies are giving this money to the government and the government's choosing not to give it to the people, aren't the oil companies kind of in collusion with this government? In other words, the oil companies want to keep this type of government in so that their profits aren't touched, or, you know what I mean? Isn't there some responsibility there? You know, these oil companies are making money and seeing how abused it's used,
right?
Or the abuse.
Well, yeah. You raise a good point. I mean, if you sort of look at the letter of the law, the contracts written between, say, Shell Oil and the Nigerian government, they're hardly exploitative of Nigeria. I mean, as I said, 60, 70, 80, I've heard even 90% of the oil profits go back to Nigeria, and Shell walks away with 10% or something like that. I mean, that's a very, very favorable contract for the Nigerian government. 10% of the oil coming out of Nigeria is still an enormous amount of money. And so if you just look at the contract between Shell and the Nigerian government, it doesn't matter what government's in there, Shell is still paying the same amount. I don't think they really care if it's a military dictatorship or a democracy or what have you. They're paying an enormous amount of the money they make back to Nigeria. I don't think they particularly care. I mean, it's not like Nigeria is going to nationalize the oil industry. So I don't think the international companies really care what kind of government it is. They're paying a huge amount. Where their moral responsibility comes in mm-hmm. my opinion, is mm-hmm. I would say to the multinational companies, listen, it's true, you are discharging your duties adequately, you're paying a huge amount of money to the government, but the reality is that government is completely rotten.
Right.
And why don't you dredge up another $100 million and just bring electricity to these villages? You don't have to.
Yes.
It's a mm-hmm. gift. It's not an obligation. But you know what? Everyone stands to gain. And mm-hmm. that's on that level, I think you're right. It's not a legal obligation, but it would sure be good for everybody. It's on sort of that level that I would criticize them.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, thanks very much for the call. So, why don't they do that? Do they not think about it, or?
Well, there are some projects, some community projects that they're pointing to. They're drilling wells here and bringing electricity there, but it's not comprehensive. And, you know, frankly, it's a complicated place. Often the headman of a village will say, we don't want you drilling a well here. You give us the money and we'll drill it. We want control of our et cetera, et cetera. Well, mm-hmm. What happens, because it's such a corrupt society, is that headman then just takes the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the oil companies are doing plenty of things wrong, or have done plenty of things wrong, but it's also an extremely complicated situation where there are sort of no complete innocents. There
right.
are no
yeah.
absolute good guys. But that said, I think the resistance to it is, as one oil worker said, you know, you drill a well here, you bring a generator into this village, suddenly everyone wants one, and you now have an overwhelming task.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they don't even want to start thinking that way, because they don't know where the process will end.
Yeah. But isn't there somebody who can bring pressure to bear on the Nigerian government? These guys are corrupt, and they got their planes and their prostitutes and whatever because of the oil money coming their way. It would seem to me as though the oil companies, with international pressure from all of the countries who are benefiting from the Nigerian oil, could say, hey, you gotta do something other than what
right.
you're doing with this money, or we're out of here.
Well, that yes, you're right. But then there's another level of complexity, which is, Western oil companies are actually starting to pull out, not because they're incredibly principled, but because it's just costing too much to work there because of the hostages, the kidnappings,
right.
the destruction to the oil infrastructure.
Yeah.
They're just starting to pull out.
Yeah.
What's filling the vacuum are Iranian and Chinese oil companies that are coming in and writing contracts with the Nigerian government to build oil infrastructure. So if Western oil companies pulled out, immediately Iran and China would be there. And you basically trade one actor for another in the area.
Mm. Thanks very much, Pat, for your call. Let's go next to June from Shawano. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
Give you a little background on Nigeria. The war with Biafra ended in 1969, and during that time, Nigeria was not divided into the many states it is now, but into three regions, which were the Hausa, the Yoruba, and the Igbo. At that time, I worked for Mobil Oil, and my project was to determine who could be hired to work in the oil industry, and I did a study on that, and primarily because the rivers state, as it's called now, is divided up primarily because of geography and isolated. You have so many different tribal groups. Ijaw is one of the largest, but there are many others. There was no education in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in Lagos, and the people who came from that area had to come to Lagos to get their education or go to Benin. At that time, it was a city in Nigeria, not a country.
Mm-hmm.
And no education funds were available. This is something I advised that they could do to help people get jobs in the oil industry. But, of course, it was a long process. Additionally, these people, because they're all spread out and have different tribal groups, have no power in Nigeria. The current president is Yoruba, and the Hausa are primarily Muslim and are, as you've probably heard in the past, running their region under Islamic law. And some of these skirmishes are because the Igbos move into the areas doing civil service work. And this was one of the reasons for the war called Biafra, was because at that time the eastern region, which is primarily Igbo,
mm-hmm.
could get control of that oil. And, it didn't work out. And prior to oil, this is a thing that I've seen happen in so many countries. Prior to to the discovery of oil. Nigeria did not have to import food. They fed all their people from the food that was there. With the coming of oil, they could get foreign exchange, and now mm-hmm. they're importing it. And, of course, the people who are importing it are the people who have the money.
Yeah.
It has been explained so well. That's where the money goes.
Mm-hmm. It's what's so ironic about all of this, isn't it? As we pointed to before, Sebastian, such a rich place, you know, you can't imagine there to be such poverty when there's such wealth. It's a...
Yes, it's, you know, it's one of the poorest countries in the world, despite having this enormous oil revenue, and it's something that economists know as, or people in the development business know as the curse of resources. If you have a very, particularly in Africa, if you have a very, very valuable resource like oil or diamonds, it leads to corruption, it leads to infighting, and ultimately to civil war, and so you have countries like Angola and Sierra Leone and Congo that are much, much worse off, even though they actually have very valuable mineral and oil deposits within their borders. A country like Senegal, which doesn't have anything like that, they export food. They export mm-hmm. vegetables and grains, and they're not a wealthy, wealthy country, but they're much more stable. The standard of living is much higher than in Nigeria. It's one of the ironies of West Africa.
Hmm. And do you want to explain a little bit more the religious element here? Is it an Islamic country, or we got a whole lot of different faith groups?
It's really divided just about down the middle, east-west, between the Muslim faith in the north and Christianity in the south. And then we in the south, there are also very, very intense tribal older pre-Christian religions that, for example, the Egbesu, the warrior cult of Egbesu, which clearly is not a Christian, it's not a Christian sect, but it's sort of Christianity has sort of overlaid those older beliefs.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome more phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest is Sebastian Younger. His piece, Blood Oil, is in the recent issue of Vanity Fair, and you can read it by going to vanityfair.com. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050, for those of you who are joining us in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Sebastian. And our next caller is Teju from Madison. Hi, Teju.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks very much for the program. I just want to make one or two contributions. The first is what Sebastian said earlier about the ethnic composition of the military. I think what you said needs some clarification because the Nigerian military is actually one of the most integrated in the country. And what he saw in the Niger Delta was a program began after the Civil War of unifying the, you know, the country by posting military people from one ethnic group, to the other. I mean, that's the theory. Whether it's working is a different issue. So if you go to, you know, some ethnic area, some ethnic groups, you find military people from other, ethnic groups. One other issue, of course, is the corruption, which I think he has talked about very well and which I, agree with. But I think, there's also one important issue to look at, which is to address, the legal framework that actually made that corruption, that gave it teeth in that context. And that is that there's a formula for distributing the national wealth in that place, which is, extremely ridiculous. Where this is based on population areas, and there's very little about area from which the the mineral wealth is derived from. So there's a lot of issue apart from corruption, and there's this issue of the legal framework which actually encourages the corruption. And then finally, we've talked about protecting Nigerian oil. I think we should actually be talking of the opposite, which is actually to boycott you know, Nigerian oil, because although there's great poverty in the Niger Delta, that's not the only place that's poor in Nigeria. The problem, you know, in that country is, of course, the political class. If you go to the north, too, you see extreme, poverty. You know, so we have here, a very cannibalistic, political class against its own people. You know, no matter where the people are. I mean, the irony in this case, as Sebastian has shown quite well, the irony is that this is the only, foreign exchange earner for the, for the country, and the poverty is just so extreme where that foreign exchange earner, is produced. So this is the extreme irony. But otherwise, the question of the extreme poverty of the people is actually, very general within the country. And one way to redeem that is actually to threaten the Nigerian government to stop buying the oil if he doesn't get his house in order.
Mm-hmm. Sebastian.
Well, you're very, obviously very knowledgeable about the topic, and I unfortunately didn't have a chance to travel around Nigeria except in the Delta. So I didn't see that. I just, in terms of the integration of the military, I just know that in the Delta, people sort of complained that the soldiers were all from other parts of Nigeria, and there was a sort of tribal friction there that really worried people. It's so bad in Nigeria. The corruption is so bad, and just the failure of government services is so chronic that Nigeria has to import refined oil. In other words, the gas that gets put in people's cars in Nigeria, this is one of the biggest oil-producing countries in the world, that gas comes from outside of the country because their own refineries have fallen into disuse.
Incredible.
They're broken down, they don't work, and there's actually a gasoline shortage in Nigeria because they have to buy in refined oil. It is and on every level, there's been a failure of government to provide services to the people. That if you have a car accident, I mean, the roads haven't been repaired since the 1960s. They're a deadly nightmare. And if you have a car accident, and these accidents happen all the time, if you're wounded, if you're injured lying on the side of the road after a car accident and the police come, you have to bribe them or they won't call an ambulance for you. It is just, it's just heartbreaking, the level of breakdown in that society.
Yeah. They have elections coming up sometime in April, don't they?
They do.
Are those worth mentioning?
Well, yes. I asked a friend of mine there, a Nigerian man, if the elections were going to be violent, if people were going to die in the election process, and he looked at me just incredulously. He said, "Of course people are going to die." He said, "If we won the World Cup, people would die in Nigeria." I mean, the society is so on edge that even something as wonderful as winning the World Cup would trigger riots and street fights in the street and just agitation. And so the elections, I think they're widely feared as potentially extremely violent. And the ruling party has experienced a recent sort of political victory that a lot of the, I think, 135 opposition candidates have been declared too corrupt to run.
Oh, my gosh.
And you know, they probably are too corrupt to run, really? But, of course, so is most of the ruling party. So there's this sort of jockeying going on right now that I think could turn into real. I mean, obviously, everyone hopes that it doesn't, but it really it could turn extremely violent, I think.
Mm. What about Teju's mention of a boycott of oil from Nigeria?
Well, again, if we, the West, refused to buy Nigerian oil, I think Russia, China, there'd be many other countries in the world that would be happy to take it off their hands for them. You'd need a true global oil boycott of Nigerian oil, and I think the politics of arranging that would be just insurmountable.
Mm-hmm. Time for a couple more phone calls. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Jeff from Madison, hi.
Yes, good for you for researching this. I was in Nigeria as a graduate student 27 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard many of the same things you've been saying then. So I'm not at all, unfortunately, optimistic about it. Just a few facts that were people were wondering out there. In the north, the House and Fulani, who do basically or have traditionally controlled the higher echelons of the military, they make up about 29-30% of the country. The Yoruba is about a fifth. And this group you're talking about, the Ija, while the woman is right in saying they're the fourth largest, they're only about 10%. And so if you consider that the government, when one of your callers said, you know, the government taking the revenues from the people, there is such pressure for whoever is in the government to take whatever revenues there are personally and secondarily to send them to the region from which that person or those persons are from, there just isn't much of a capacity in that region, the Ija, to affect any kind of advocacy, any kind of change at the government level. And I think that's what I think is so just heartrending about it. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't see the way out of it.
That's right. And there's even a formula. God, let me try to remember. I think it's either 13% or 18%. Of oil revenue that must go back to the areas where the oil is drilled, where it comes from. And that goes, the problem with it, that 13%, whatever it 18, whatever it is, that percentage does go, say, to Rivers State, one of the states in the Niger Delta, but it goes to the governor's office. And it really never leaves the government, the governor's office. I mean, it's, some of it even does go locally. But that's a whole new problem. That's just another layer of corruption for it to fight its way through. And what the few drops of revenue that eventually sort of leak into the local communities is really, it's barely enough to do anything. And meanwhile, the governor of Bayelsa State was recently indicted and arrested on corruption charges. And I think it was something to the tune of stealing $400 million or something like that. I mean, just enormous amounts of money. It's been estimated that the Nigerian government over the decades has stolen or misused, in other words, built palaces and that sort of thing, something like $400 billion.
Oh, my gosh, Rich.
Which is as much, it rivals the amount of all Western financial aid to all of Africa in that time.
Wow.
It's staggering. It's absolutely
staggering. Somebody needs to offer courses in what is the meaning of life. What is a life well lived to all of these people, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Thanks very much for the call. We go to Chris from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. I just wanted to say thank you. It's so refreshing to hear the truth coming out about the corruption in Nigeria. My father was a petroleum engineer with Mobil Oil in the 70s, and as a child I lived there for 4 years. Mm. And I just wanted to comment, just over the years of my life, the frustration that I've experienced whenever you bring up that, you know, my father was in the oil business, you know, you always get these kind of looks. And our family was always frustrated because we knew about the corruption in Nigeria. And my father and all the families there, they worked very hard, you know, to produce the oil and actually put their families at risk living there. I mean, we had tanks down our street at time. Our school was surrounded by soldiers with machine guns. I almost died of malaria. I mean, we went through a lot of risk, and my dad and his coworkers worked very hard at Mobil Oil. He said he was very proud of that company. It was a very clean company. It was not corrupt, and they worked very, very hard to get that oil out of the ground. And I, as a child, used to go and visit some of those facilities, and my father was always very proud to say these villages were very poor and very dirty when we arrived. And I, as a child, I could see that Mobil had built clinics and provided for these people. They had jobs. They were happy. It was a very clean, clean facility. I used to play around that area when I was a child and visit even the rigs out on the ocean, the offshore oil rigs. My father would take us out there to see that. And anyway, it's refreshing to hear the honesty of what's going on with the Nigerian government and the extreme corruption. Mm-hmm. And it's not just all the oil companies. Their job is their job is not political. Their job is to go and get the oil out of the ground, you know, and produce that oil. And even one day shutting down the oil field, they're losing a tremendous amount of oil, and it's just catastrophic. And anyway, I just saw a lot of families working very hard, being at risk, actually.
Right. All right, we need to hold you there. We're almost out of time. Sebastian?
Yes. When I was there, I did hear that different oil companies had sort of different reputations, and some were acknowledged to be very, very responsible and sort of trying to do the right thing in a very difficult situation. And other companies, I mean, I don't want to name names, but other companies were thought to be just absolutely reprehensible. So there is, even in the oil companies, there really was a huge spectrum of different kinds of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Sebastian, thank you so much for being with us. What an interesting part of the world, and you're a great reporter. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sebastian Younger, he is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, and the article is Blood Oil. It appears in the issue that's, well, some of you may have it, or if you'd like to get it, you can go to vanityfair.com. That's vanityfair.com, and look for the article by Sebastian. It is titled Blood Oil. Thanks to Rita Thomas for producing this hour, and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. If you'd like a copy of this show, call the radio store. The phone number is 800-747-7444, and the program number of this hour is 216E, 216E. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.